Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey, it's Jonathan from Good Life Project. If you are in your 30s or 40s with friends too busy to join you on a vacation, you have to check out Flashpack, the only group travel brand for solo travelers your age. Imagine dining with sumos in Japan or basking on a private yacht in Croatia, all with people like you. Visit flashpack.com/podcast to save $250 on your booking, an offer only available until July 15th.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1300 hours GMT on the 5th of June 2023, these are our main stories. Russia reports fighting with Ukrainian forces across the southeast. Meanwhile, thousands of Ukrainians are returning to their homes close to the front line, even though officials are urging them to stay away. More than 180 victims of the Odisha rail disaster in India are yet to be identified, nearly 3 days after the crash. In Australia, a woman who spent 20 years in jail for killing her four children has been released.
I recommended that the governor should exercise the royal prerogative of mercy and grant Ms. Folbig an unconditional pardon. The governor agreed.
We find out why. Also in this podcast, mobile internet has been shut down in Senegal following deadly protests against the sentencing of an opposition leader. We start in Ukraine, where there's fierce fighting across a number of locations across Russian-occupied south and east of the country. That's according to the Russian Ministry of Defence. The ministry has released video of what it says are battles on Sunday, showing armoured vehicles coming under heavy fire. The quality of the footage is poor, so the BBC has been unable to verify the time and place in the recording. Russian army chiefs claim to have killed 250 troops and to have destroyed 16 armoured Ukrainian vehicles. If confirmed, this could be the start of the much-expected Ukrainian counteroffensive and a major escalation in the conflict. Russian spokesman Igor Konashenkov said Kyiv's attempted assault in five locations has failed.
С утра 4 июня противник начал крупномасштабное наступление.
On the morning of the 4th of June 2023, the enemy launched a large-scale offensive at five sections of the southern Donetsk front. They introduced into combat the 23rd and 31st mechanized brigades from the strategic reserves of the Ukrainian armed forces, supported by other military units and divisions. A total of six mechanized and two tank battalions from the enemy were involved. The enemy's goal was to break through Russia's defenses in what it considered to be the most vulnerable area of the front. The enemy was unsuccessful in achieving its goals.
The BBC's James Waterhouse is in Kyiv, and I asked him, what do we know?
The picture is often murky, but I think if you look at the claims by Russia's Defence Ministry that it's repelled an attack, that it's killed hundreds of Ukrainian troops, that the releasing of footage showing armoured vehicles being destroyed, it's also suggesting there have been other Ukrainian advances. If you look at that, as well as Ukrainian claims of gains elsewhere along the front line, I think we're seeing Moscow trying to seize control of the narrative as Ukraine starts its offensive. This long-awaited counterpunch, it's been so desperate to both initiate, but it also, you know, it wants it to succeed. There has been a notable increase in military activity. There's been a heightening of the tone of the political rhetoric around Ukraine's capability, what its hopes are. And I think while expectations are being managed a bit by the West in terms of what can be done over what time, it seems Ukraine, after months of being on the receiving end of wave after wave of Russian attack, it seems Ukraine is trying to push back.
You're in Kyiv. Are they saying anything there about this offensive?
They're not, and I'm not expecting them to. I think there is a kind of, to use a British political term, you know, there's a constructive ambiguity to Kyiv's messaging. Over the weekend, they released a video showing Ukrainian soldiers saying shush, putting their fingers over their mouths and saying, planning loves silence. And I think this is mostly an attempt to keep Moscow guessing. You've had President Zelensky say that he's ready, that Ukraine is ready. Yes, they need a few things here and there. But I think more pertinently, he said, this isn't a movie. You know, we're not talking about the great comeback in a film. This isn't, you know, some kind of movie trailer. And he's urged people to personally thank soldiers that they know. And I think that is the point here as well, where there is no doubt Ukraine is starting this counteroffensive. But the human loss that lies ahead as it tries to retake what was taken as long as 9 years ago, the human cost is going to be high as it ever has been.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. Meanwhile, at a meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, the safety of Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear plant, Europe's largest, is high on the agenda. Iran's nuclear program will also come under the microscope of the board of the UN's nuclear watchdog. The BBC's Bethany Bell is in the Austrian capital and told us more about the concerns over Ukraine.
Just a few days ago, the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, urged both Russia and Ukraine to commit to a number of principles to ensure the safety at Zaporizhia, which, of course, is in the middle of a fighting zone in Ukraine. And he said that it was crucial that there should be no attacks to this plant or from the plant, that there should be no heavy weapons there, and that everything should be done to ensure that there should be off-site power in order to cool the reactors. And so this is one of the things that will be under discussion here at the IAEA. Neither Russia nor Ukraine has committed to these principles, but Mr. Grossi has repeatedly stressed how precarious and dangerous the situation is at the Zaporizhia plant.
Bethany Bell. More than 180 victims of the Odisha rail disaster in India are yet to be identified, nearly 3 days after the crash. Three trains collided on Friday, killing 275 people and injuring more than 1,000. India's railway minister has suggested it was caused by a signal fault. The government has been giving family members of those who died $1,250 in compensation, as Achana Shukla reports from Odisha.
A paycheck he hesitates to collect. Gautam Das was meant to be on the same ill-fated train as his wife, but stayed back to run a last-minute errand. My wife's image keeps flashing before my eyes. What am I to do that my wife is gone? Money can be earned later, but nothing can bring her back, Gautam tells me. Family members have been gathering at this centre after the government announced compensation of £1,000 for the kin of the deceased. For others, the painful search is still on. Sifting through photos, from hospital to hospital, and now morgue to morgue. Inconsolable and traumatized.
Hello.
22-year-old Himanshu can barely speak. His brother was on the train that crashed. Can I see my brother? Just once, he keeps repeating. At this makeshift morgue, he's just one of many who don't have answers yet. 10 members of Mukul Singh's family were on the train. 8 found, 1 dead, and 1 still missing. His family spent £450, much beyond their means, to come here from another state. These photos are unrecognizable. How can we find him in this? I had never thought this would happen. Just a day before, we had so much fun, he tells me.
With limited resources to manage the dead, government has now shifted all the casualties to the capital city, 5 hours away from here. But over 180 bodies still remain unidentified. Officials have started posting the photos of dead bodies on government websites and have said they'll start resorting to DNA identification.
These tracks that tell the story of loss are still being cleared. Rail service has been restored on some tracks. Attention has now turned to just why this disaster happened.
Achana Shukla. Senegal's government has cut access to mobile internet services after 3 days of violent protest that led to the deaths of 16 people. The demonstrations took place after the conviction of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko on Thursday on charges of corrupting a young woman, charges he says are politically motivated. The two-year sentence angered Mr. Sonko's supporters, who say they fear this will disqualify him from running in the presidential election next February. Here's a resident of Dakar, Alioune Badara.
I'm a Senegalese citizen living here in Senegal. People are very upset against the government. We all know that they want to eliminate the main opponent for the presidential election. This fight is beyond the conviction of Ousmane Sonko. People have to understand that. We are tired of our poor day-to-day life. The young are not working. They get unlimited free time. We can't see any improvement in ourselves toward what is shown on TV about Senegal. As an example, we can see during the protests people are looting in supermarket. It's just because they don't have what to eat. Obviously, the internet restriction affects everybody in the country. For now, the Wi-Fi are still working, but not the mobile data. I'm a software developer working in remote for a foreign company. I'm not sure if I will be able to work as I should tomorrow. But also in our day-to-day life, with this end of month, we can't withdraw money. Banks and mobile money apps, all of that will need internet. To be honest, I really can't see any positive perspective for our political future. Because for me, every time we choose a president, we are always disappointed. And I can feel that disappointment also with this president. We were expecting a lot. We were expecting him to change the situation of many persons in our country. But this ending, it's really a tragedy. In our country, having two deaths in the same day, we can't imagine that. And look where we are now. It's the first time in this country.
Alioune Badara. It's more than 100 years since a senior member of the British royal family gave evidence in person in court from the witness box. Then it involved a prince over a card game. On Tuesday, Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex, is due to appear at the High Court in London in his case against Mirror Group newspapers. The younger son of King Charles alleges information was gathered unlawfully on him over a 14-year period, starting when he was just 12 years old. I asked our media and culture editor, Katie Razzle, what we can expect from the prince's case.
We expect him to be in court tomorrow. His case opens today with lawyers making the arguments. And this is about him claiming that journalists and private investigators involved with three British tabloids owned by the Mirror Group, that they accessed his voicemail messages and used other methods, including hiring private detectives, between 1996 and 2011 to write stories about him. And he's submitted a lot of articles, almost around 140, to the court that he says relied on illegally obtained information. They've whittled that down to 33, and it's articles, you know, things like, you know, an article written in 1996 when he was a child and his mother, Princess Diana, visited him at school, articles about sporting injuries he got at school that he claims were based on private medical information, articles about his relationships with, you know, various different girlfriends, and about his drug taking and partying. I think everyone will have taken on board that Prince Harry feels huge antipathy to the tabloid press, but this week it seems like there will be a day of reckoning for him in that witness box.
And what is the Mirror saying? Because they have apologised for one instance, haven't they?
In one instance, they have admitted that they hired a private investigator back in 2004 to unlawfully gather information about him in a nightclub. But that's not part of this case. Broadly, what they say is they didn't hack his phone, and that the articles that he's relying on saying they did actually were acquired in lots of different ways, tips from sources, exclusives from other papers, even briefings by royal staff. Now, they have admitted hacking once took place at the papers, but they just deny he was ever a target. They have settled more than 600 claims and paid out more than £100 million in damages and costs. But crucially, they say it didn't happen in Prince Harry's case. And they also say that it is not the case, as he is suggesting and other claimants in this trial are suggesting, that people at the top of the paper, editors, lawyers, managers, that they knew anything about what was happening.
And what are the risks for Prince Harry of appearing in the witness box? Because this hasn't happened, has it, for more than 100 years for a senior British royal?
Absolutely. Not since the late 19th century has this happened. And this, you know, courts are very different places from TV interviews. This isn't Oprah Winfrey or a Netflix documentary. This will be Prince Harry facing a skillful barrister used to cross-examining witnesses. So, of course, it's definitely not without risk. Giving evidence is daunting. People can feel bruised by the experience of being in the witness box. He'll likely face detailed questioning about highly personal information. You know, how will he respond? There is no doubt he'll be under pressure. Courtrooms can bring out sides of people that you wouldn't see in normal situations, but he clearly thinks it's worth it. It is his day of reckoning, in a sense. And in the end, the court has to decide, was his phone hacked? Were private investigators used to blag private information about him? That's what the judge is going to have to decide.
Katie Razzle. Still to come on the Global News podcast, Parlez-vous Français, how France may have set the record for the largest dictation contest.
Thank you. Oh my goodness, I'm so happy you came through.
That's the sound of Kim getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be paying for her dog's much-needed MRI. And we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on a reliable, award-winning Honda, like the 2023 CR-V. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.
Hey, it's Jonathan from Good Life Project. If you are in your 30s or 40s with friends too busy to join you on a vacation, you have to check out Flashpack, the only group travel brand for solo travelers your age. Imagine dining with sumos in Japan or basking on a private yacht in Croatia, all with people like you. Visit flashpack.com/podcast to save $250 on your booking, and offer only available until July 15th.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service that goes beyond the spin, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news. An honest explanation of the events shaping our lives. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. A woman once branded Australia's worst female serial killer has been pardoned and freed from prison after new evidence suggested she did not kill her four children. Kathleen Fulpig spent 20 years in jail, but scientists now believe the children may have died of natural causes. Phil Mercer is in Sydney.
The two girls, Sarah and Laura, are said to have had a rare genetic mutation that could have caused heart problems and sudden death. One of the boys was reportedly suffering from a neurogenetic disorder linked to epilepsy. So all of this scientific evidence has been brought to bear on this extraordinary case. Safe to say that the trial and the conviction of Kathleen Fulbeck has become one of the most notorious cases in Australian criminal history. Her supporters believe that she will now pursue a huge compensation case.
Phil Mercer. In China, millions of students will soon be sitting the Chinese university entrance exam. It's said to be one of the hardest in the world, with students revising for up to 16 hours a day. The stakes are high, and the authorities are putting more checks in place than ever before to try to stop any cheating. Our Asia Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me more.
Well, Val, as you said, the stakes are really high. 13 million teenagers sitting down to write this year's three-day exam. That's up more than a million, almost a million, from last year. And as you said, there's new checks in place. So for the first time, many Chinese cities are installing what they are calling intelligent security checks. So basically, facial recognition technology that can check to make sure there aren't surrogate test takers, that some students haven't hired other so-called professional test takers to take the Gaokao in their place. They're also going to be banning all metal ornaments. So any necklaces, bracelets, wristwatches, anything that you might be able to use to hide a camera or a listening device in, that so that someone who's sitting outside the exam room can't be filtering, sending you the answers to the questions secretly. There have also been public warnings because apparently some criminal groups have been selling fake exam questions questions in advance of the exam, and they are warning families not to get caught out in these scams.
I mean, this suggests that cheating is a very big, very widespread problem, is it?
It's not that it's so widespread. It's that the stakes are so high. So Chinese teenagers basically spend their entire school career, 12 years, studying for just 3 days of an exam. All of these exams are really built up on the idea that this is a meritocracy, that it's the only mark that matters for you to get into a good university in China. And so that's why it's such a big deal. And everybody really wants this exam to try to be fair. And so that's why any examples of cheating are really seen as a huge taboo in China. It's really thought that you need to put the work in, and then if you get a good grade, then you'll be able to go on and have a good university career and then maybe a good job at the end of it.
Well, millions taking these exams, so are there very few places? Is it really incredibly competitive?
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. So many Chinese families only have one child, so they put all of their resources, these so-called 4-2-1 families, four grandparents, two parents, focusing on the outcome of one child. And so that's why these children really feel such burdens. They have, you know, a study for up to 16, 18 hours a day leading up to these exams. And Chinese cities really fall quiet when during the 3 days of exams. People are told not to honk their horns, not to talk too loudly outside the test centers. Parents wait outside praying while the tests are being taken. This is a big deal in China.
I mean, even I understand they've got ambulances on standby in case people are carted out from the exam because of the stress of it.
That's right. I mean, and you know, as I said, more than the number of teenagers taking the exam is up 1 million from last year. That's because so many felt the stress because the tests weren't really done during COVID. And so there were a huge surge in the number of people who'd been preparing for this last year. Now the stakes are really feel even higher this year because so much stress has gone into preparing for this exam. Even more than normal.
Celia Hatton. Whether or not Ukraine's summer offensive has got underway, thousands of Ukrainians are returning to their homes close to the front line, even though officials are urging them to stay away. Our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse, went to the eastern town of Pokrovsk to find out why some people are deciding to go home.
3 hours into our journey from the city of Dnipro, we are heading towards the town of Pokrovsk, 30 miles from the front line. And yet, this carriage is mostly made up of civilians. Yes, there are some soldiers looking out of the window, but we've met a rugby league team, as well as Victoria, who has finally decided to move back home.
It's impossible to live like we did. We traveled around, all around Slovakia, all around Ukraine. We have to settle our family. This is where we belong.
Victoria's traveling with her precious cargo on her lap. Baby Yeva. She left with her during Russia's full-scale invasion last year, but has now had enough of being a refugee.
We are very grateful to them for hosting us and not abandoning us at such times. But it's time to go home. There's no other way.
As she arrives to her hometown of Pokrovsk, she's greeted by who she left behind, her husband, Serhii.
I feel overwhelmed. I'm very glad to see my beautiful daughter and my wife. I just want us to sit, cuddle, chat, and that's it.
Pokrovsk is a gritty town very much on a war footing. There's an even mix of soldiers and civilians. Before the full-scale invasion, its population was around 60,000. It had dropped to a third, but is now rising. It's become a destination for those escaping occupied cities. Residents have also been enticed back by power and water being restored. There is a sympathy in the trenches for those moving back, from soldiers like Vyacheslav.
Some are saving their children, and some stay because it's their homeland. If you have to die, it's better to die in your motherland than somewhere abroad.
We revisit Victoria, Serhii and Yeva at their flat. It's soon clear they're not going to go back on their decision.
Who knows when it will become safe here? Maybe a year, two or five. We don't want to wait even 1 year. Overall, we are prepared.
A tone not necessarily of defiance or confidence, but perhaps it's an acceptance. This war isn't going to end soon.
James Waterhouse in Ukraine. In Hong Kong, several pro-democracy figures were arrested on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre on Sunday. Among those detained was 67-year-old campaigner Alexandra Wong, widely known as Grandma Wong, who was arrested for carrying flowers near Victoria Park, where vigils for those killed during the massacre have been held for decades. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has condemned the detentions, but China says the territory is moving from chaos to prosperity. BBC's Rob Young got the latest figures from Elaine Yu, a journalist based in Hong Kong.
So the police said more than 10 people have been brought back to the police station for questioning, and it's not clear what they have done from the statements, but from what we saw in the streets, people who wore shirts that maybe had texts or graphics that nodded to the crackdown, or people who held small candles or flowers, or performance artists, those are the people who have been led away and questioned and brought to police vans. So yeah, it looked like seemingly small acts that had been tolerated in Hong Kong for decades had led to detention by police and in some cases even arrests.
Protests have become much smaller over the past couple of years. How many people would in previous years have turned out compared to this year?
Tens of thousands would go to Victoria Park, a big park in Hong Kong, for an annual candlelight vigil commemorating the victims of the crackdown every year. And this is an interesting year because it's the first year without COVID restrictions. And the vigil had technically been banned since 2020, which is the year China imposed national security legislation on Hong Kong following mass protests previous years. But they had cited officially COVID restrictions for banning the vigil. So this is the first year without restrictions, but we still saw very heavy police presence. And I think this year, there were far fewer acts of defiance in the streets. In previous years during the pandemic, I think there were more people lighting candles and, you know, doing very small acts of remembrance in public places. But this year, there was such heavy police presence, and some people still try to go to the park or go to the vicinity of the park. But yeah, they were stopped by officers who were patrolling the area.
Elaine Yu. The Champs-Élysées in Paris was turned into a giant open-air exam hall on Sunday as thousands of people attempted to enter the record books for the world's largest dictation. Emily Brown reports.
Paris's most famous street like you've never seen before. The Champs-Élysées transformed into an open-air mass dictation spellathon. Instead of the usual flow of cars, rows of school desks lined the avenue. 5,000 people took part, aged between 10 and 90, attempting to transcribe the passages read out to them. The winners are those who didn't make a single mistake. The aim, to break the world record for the largest dictation. More than 50,000 people applied to take part. Journalist Augustin Trepenard led the first round. The excerpts range from a short story by a 19th century novelist to sports journalism and a modern text. The avenue, turned giant exam hall, epitomised a very French love affair with words.
Emily Brown. And that's ALL from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker. The producer was Andrew Cheng. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Clara Graham.
And I'm the BBC World Affairs editor, John Simpson.
And we'd like to tell you about a new podcast from the BBC World Service, The Explanation.
The Explanation looks beyond the headlines, bringing you in-depth analysis of the stories affecting our lives.
whether it's important long-running issues
or the latest global events.
We're making sense of the big stories
and giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hey, it's Jonathan from Good Life Project. If you are in your 30s or 40s with friends too busy to join you on a vacation, you have to check out Flashpack, the only group travel brand for solo travelers your age. Imagine dining with sumos in Japan or basking on a private yacht in Croatia, all with people like you. Visit flashpack.com/podcast to save $250 on your booking and offer only available until July 15th.